Sergeant Morris, relate.
You're saying that the camp at Faid was very well equipped for sport.
Yes, at last. We were together as a regiment in squadron lines. We started to play various sports with other regiments in the locality. Cricket, football, hockey, swimming. And I believe the officers even got to be playing polo quite close by. So we were really organized for the first time for many years as a regiment.
Had the regiment changed at all as a result of its involvement in the fighting in Burma?
Well, after all this time, a good proportion of the old 7th still remained. But we'd had many new entrants to the regiment, or new members to the regiment. But basically, it was the same old regiment with the same spirit, and the newcomers were soon brought into our way of thinking. In other words, for once we had a very happy regiment.
Were you still part of C Squadron?
Yes, yeah. I was still with C Squadron right up to the date I left them.
And you are now a tank driver.
I'm now a tank driver.
In one of the troops of C Squadron.
Yes, I was an acting corporal. The vast increase in rank as an acting corporal. But shortly after there, I had to leave and relinquish my tapes.
Did being an acting corporal impose any extra burdens on you? What did it entail doing?
Well, it meant certain responsibilities. I now, although I was driving a tank, I had regimental duties to do, duty NCOs, and various patrols that we had to do. And as an NCO, I took the job very seriously. And of course, we had newcomers who were looking to us for advice and help if they became uncertain, we would help them to sort out the problem.
Did being a corporal or an acting corporal change your relations with your comrades in the regiment?
No, none at all. I would like to think at this stage, as a regiment, we were one big happy family, and felt this quite a long way into my service with the 7th. There was never any animosity, even amongst the new members. Being a fighting unit and an efficient fighting unit, we treated everybody as equals. And of course, the youngsters responded.
How was it then that you didn't stay with them, that you had to leave the regiment temporarily and do other things?
At the beginning of April, I believe, of 1944, a notice was circulated to all regiments, to all army units, that those people who had been abroad 5 years or more under a scheme called Python could have the chance of staying on with the regiment or returning to the UK. I chose the latter. I volunteered to come home to see friends and relatives in England and hopefully a more peaceful life. But that was not to be.
What was the journey back like? How did you get back to England?
On the appointed day, about 40 members from my regiment who had decided to return to England embarked on a convoy to the UK. this convoy itself was very hectic. On several occasions, we were attacked, or the convoy was attacked by German submarines. And in fact, we had to go well over to the United States of America before passing round the German wolf packs and eventually disembarked at Liverpool.
What impression did England make on you when you came back to it? Because it's been some time since you've been in England.
Well, the first impression we had was wonderful. We arrived at Liverpool on a very misty morning by the Liver buildings. We had huge crowds waiting to meet us. We had WVS personnel offering us huge sandwiches and mugs of tea and well wishes before we were loaded onto trains to make our way back to our base at Catterick, RAC Army base at Catterick Camp in Yorkshire. From there, we were documented, re-equipped, having lost a lot of our equipment en route. We were re-equipped, and although we did not know it, we were being earmarked as a possible reinforcement to the invasion of Europe plan. And consequently, we were sent to an armoured reinforcement depot at Manningtree, near Colchester.
What was going on there?
This camp was run very strictly. We had a guard sergeant major who was all mouth and gaiters. He used to shout at us from dawn till dusk and expected us all to follow suit. But unfortunately, a lot of us rebelled. Although we still maintained our army sense of discipline, each day, or most days, we were called upon to do a 5-mile route march through the streets and around Colchester with full pack and rifle at a pretty hectic pace. And it's surprising how fit this alone made you. We were being held there prior to the invasion of Europe, and obviously during this period we did no other training other than fitness parades.
You said that some of you rebelled against this Guard Sergeant Major. What form did the rebellion take?
Rebellion is a wrong word to use there. When shouted at, firstly we objected to the shouting, so we did everything very reluctantly, although in the end we did it. But rebellion isn't the right word. We disliked his manner. Mm-hmm. Had he a more sensible approach, I think he would have got more out of us, or more cooperation out of us. Mm-hmm. But it did prove in the end to make us more fit, although at this time we received no further training until, of course, we were received by our new units.
Did you have any idea of where you would like to be sent?
No, the destination was kept quite secret. In fact, when the invasion of Europe took place in June 44, it was not for some time until we were required to replace those who had been killed or wounded. And I remember one morning about 20 of us were detailed to pack our bags and to make ready to go across the channel.
Did you know at that stage when where you were going to be, who you were going to be serving with?
No, we didn't. We didn't know where we were going. Mm. We packed our bags, were sent down to Lewis on the south coast, where we were put aboard a motor torpedo boat. There were only 20 of us.
Were you from all from the same regiment? We were all 7th Hussars.
No, we were all various types of personnel from various regiments, but being all in the armoured corps,
yes,
we were all classified as armoured reinforcements, and whether they wanted one or two tank drivers or two operators or two gunners, we were selected by trade rather than ability. And consequently, when we went down to Lewis in Sussex, we were put aboard this motor torpedo boat, and the next thing we know, we landed at Arromanches in Normandy.
Did you come in via the Mulberry Harbour?
Yes, the Mulberry Harbour had just been installed, so we had quite a comfortable and dry landing, and taken immediately to a holding camp quite close to the beaches.
Do you have any idea where that was? Any more detailed idea?
No, it was within a few hundred yards from the beach.
It was just inland. Just inland. Arromanches. What sort of holding camp was it? What facilities did it have?
It was a basic camp. Obviously, the people coming and going quite quickly. There was no stability about it. And as soon as you came here, the camp would know who wanted a driver, who wanted a gunner. So we were allocated as the need arose. Fortunately for me, I was posted with a couple of other lads to the Sherwood Rangers as a tank driver.
The camp, was this just a tented camp?
Just a tented camp, yes. Mm-hmm. With the basics, just enough a room, a place to sleep, place to wash, and facilities for eating.
How did you get to the Sherwood Rangers?
Well, I remember being taken by a lorry. We were told where we were going.
Do you remember where that was, where they were when you joined them?
Yes, they were just outside of Bayeux, because they hadn't moved far from Bayeux.
What were they doing when you got there?
Well, they were in a probing location. They were trying to probe through a place called Villiers Bocage. And east of Caen, I remember, and it was just we used to have to go out on patrol each day trying to make our way forward, and in some cases we did, in other days we wouldn't get very far.
Which squadron were you put in?
I was in B squadron, Sherwood Rangers.
And what job did you get given when you...
What I wanted, a tank driver.
So you were in a troop of Shermans.
I was a troop of Shermans. Our troops of in B squadron, each troop consisted of four tanks. Three of them were Shermans, but the fourth one was a Cromwell fitted with a 17-pounder gun. And that was called a Firefly.
What were you driving, a Sherman?
I was driving the diesel Sherman.
What could you see when you were actually sitting in your driver's seat? And
if we were battened down for battle, very little. You had just a narrow aperture to look through. Although we had the facilities of a periscope, they were totally inadequate. But of course, it was a comfortable position. The tank, we felt reasonably secure in there. Until we heard otherwise.
So you arrived, and you were... Who actually told you where to go and what to do when you were?
Well, we reported to regimental headquarters, who sent us out to the B Squadron location, and it was during the fighting that we would just have to wait until the troop came in, and quite unceremoniously, we were said, "Well, here's your new troop. This is your troop leader. This is your troop NCO," and that was it.
Do you remember who your troop leader was?
I can't remember. I can't remember. You see, in those days, there was no mixing of people one with another. We were so intent on each day's activities that very seldom did we get to know anyone outside of our troop.
How were you received by the crew when you arrived?
The crew, we were very fortunate because the crew that I went to had been with the squadron ever since the landing, and they'd gone through a very traumatic time, but this made no difference. They were all ex-regulars. Being a yeomanry regiment and being all ex-regulars, they were wonderful people, and they made me welcome the moment I arrived. In fact, I fitted in at once and became part of the team.
And no period of settling in required?
No period of settling. In fact, the next day we were out on patrol again.
Do you know where you went or what you did on that patrol? Do you remember any details about it?
Well, I remember one of the days we went out east of Bayo to a place called Jerks. J-E-R-Q-U-E-S. Which was along a main highway leading towards St. Lo. And a Tiger tank had been reported by the infantry, and we were sent along to try and locate and destroy it. After a stealthy approach towards this village, we saw, lo and behold, our objective, a huge Tiger tank, standing quite openly. We made a very cautious approach to within 600 yards, and our gunner trained his gun on the direction by the tank commander. On the word fire, all hell let loose, and we received a direct hit on this Tiger. But to our great dismay, we saw the shot deflect off the turret. I did not wait for any further instruction. I threw the tank into reverse and immediately moved back towards cover. Just as well, because within 10 seconds, a shell had landed where we had been sitting. And one learnt these tricks the hard way. Had I been a novice driver, waiting to be told, I might never have received another order.
What was the countryside like for driving in Normandy?
The countryside was dreadful. The Bocage country prevented you from crossing fields. You had to stick to these low embankments, which were ideal places for ambush. Fortunately, we had quite a good section of infantry around us at most times, and we were well protected. But of course, our troop and squadron leaders were well experienced, and they knew what pitfalls to look for and guided us safely through these battles.
Where did the infantry come from? Were they part of the brigade you were in, or
no?
Were they
being an independent brigade, as a troop or a squadron, we were sent to where the need was most.
Yes.
And we never knew from one day to another where we would be.
Mm.
Sometimes we would be with one lot of troops. Next day we might be 10 miles away, and we never knew, except that we did know that we were protected by infantry.
When the infantry were protecting you, how would they do that?
Well, first of all, they would make their presence known. And they used to talk to us. At the rear of each tank, we had a field telephone. which was a telephone mounted on the rear of the tank, by which, when pressing a button, the tank commander would be aware of the phone being used, and the infantryman would talk to the tank commander without the need for either to get out of the tank. And he'd probably say, well, we're looking after you. What do you want us to do?
What did you normally want them to do?
Just stay close.
Would they go ahead of you, or would they be just behind you, or
obviously,
on either side?
Obviously, they would probe ahead of us a little bit to try and counter the threat of bazookas or anti-tank guns. Mm. But if it was dangerous, then we used to use our HE guns or machine guns to clear the path.
What was the main threat to the Sherman tank in Normandy? Was it the Tiger tank? Was it the Panzerfaust man? Or was it mining? You know, what was it that most concerned you?
Well, I think the 88 tank, or they had a 75mm anti-tank gun, which was very effective. But our main threat was the 88 tank, the 88mm tank gun. That could destroy us at 1,000 yards or more. And we had no countermeasure to combat this. But the Panzerfaust anti-tank rocket launcher was just as dangerous. In fact, it was very effective. So we had to be always alert. We used to have to anticipate where one might be and to ensure there was no threat. We used to put down a couple of high explosive shells or rake the area with machine gun fire just to ensure some degree of safety.
What sort of places would they be lying in wait then?
Well, they would hide behind these ridges along the bocage or on bends of the road or behind in little copses of wood. Any place that would be defensively easy to... Any defensive area would contain the threat.
If you were doing this shooting in advance at likely hiding, this would mean you'd use an awful lot of ammunition, wouldn't you, as you were going along?
Not too much. For instance, if we thought we were going into a dangerous situation where there was maybe a barn or somewhere that looked suspicious, we'd put one HE shell in the middle of it.
Yes.
Now that one HE shell has a big spread of explosive. I don't mean we'd waste ammunition. We were very conscious of the...
But if you were going down a lane, I mean, presumably a lot of the time you were confined to roads because of the bocage.
Yeah.
Presumably there would be lots of places where...
There would be lots of places, but inevitably we'd have an infantry escort who would be probing ahead.
How far ahead of you would they actually be if they were giving you that
20,
protection?
20, 30 yards minimum. And of course we had to be very careful that we didn't accidentally shoot up our own infantrymen, so there was always a sense of caution about our advances.
Did you see much of the enemy? You were saying that you saw very few Japanese in Burma.
Well, here again, most of the fighting in Normandy was from behind a screen of trees or hedgerows, although on several occasions we actually had contact with the enemy and actually saw what damage we were doing. A lot of the time it was just not supposition, but the threat was there and we had to eliminate it.
So you were really anticipating, weren't you?
You had to anticipate. You had to anticipate the next move. Because if you went along in a leisurely manner, chances are that you'd never make it.
Now, you said you saw that Tiger tank that you engaged on your first day, and so on. How many occasions did you actually see enemy armoured vehicles, do you think, while you were...
Well, I was only with the Sherwood Rangers about 3 months. Some of that time was taken on following up the German retreat, but in actual fighting days, perhaps on about 4 or 5 separate occasions, we'd actually bumped into pockets of resistance which contained armour or Panzerfaust troops.
But I mean, it's one of the features of modern warfare seems to be that it's very rare for you to actually see your enemy
that's
in
true,
plain
yes.
view.
Yeah, that's true.
Do you remember taking part in any set piece actions in your?
Yes, we had two in particular. Mm. We had to advance through a farmyard, and we didn't know what was at the other end of it, except that we knew that one of the German infantrymen had fired a Panzerfaust at our tank and hit our suspension, which took away part of the suspension. And we knew for a fact that there was a line being held. So with all other three tanks, the four of us made a concerted approach, firing as we went onto a set German position. And after about a quarter of an hour, we had overcome the position, and we did in fact know for certain that that was a strong point which we had overtaken.
When you were firing on the advance, were you firing on the move?
Firing on the move.
And what were you using, the main armament or
well,
the
I
machine
was,
guns?
I was a driver.
Yes.
I had beside me a co-driver
yes.
who was firing the Sponson gun.
Yes.
Whereas my tank commander was directing the main gun, HE and the machine gun.
And you're firing the main armament while you're actually motoring forward.
Not for pure accuracy. We'd fire the machine guns whilst we were moving to gain ground, but for any accuracy we'd stop momentarily while he got a shot off and then we'd move.
Yeah. That's because it must have been virtually impossible to keep the gun stable and fixed.
Well, yes, until later on when the stabilizers came. But it's hard to imagine for those who've never been in a tank with the engine roaring and the gun pounding away and the machine guns chattering away. It's like hell. It's like Dante's Inferno at times. And you can't make sense, head no sense out of anything till peace reigns again.
And presumably you would be sitting there and your orders would come through on the headphones.
Yes, through the intercom.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, were you given a continuous stream of directions or were you...
No, we could pick up what was going on by the messages coming from troop to troop.
Yes.
The troops were talking to each other and one would say perhaps, we used to call ourselves Able or Baker tanks. Baker, there's movement so far to your front, to the right, be prepared for something in that direction. Of course, you'd be watching that, and you can imagine what was taking place just by listening in the headphones.
So you could hear the troop net from
your...
You
could hear it,
yes.
There's a filter through, you could hear a bit of it.
Was there a squadron net or a regimental net, or was it a...
Well, the squadron net would normally be held by... headquarters squadron, which is normally to the rear a bit.
Yes.
He would be directing his squadron tanks in front. So he would be in contact with further behind a regimental or brigade or whoever we were with.
So your awareness was really limited to your
very
own
limited.
Tank and the and
very,
the troop
very
net.
Limited indeed.
Yes.
We only got a fleeting glimpse.
I mean, did the commander of the tank expect you to find your own way forward, or would he be directing?
No, he would tell us. He said we'll have to make for that. We'd have to make for that ridge, but keep below it rather than above it.
Yeah.
Because of obvious reasons. He'd tell you which way he'd like you to go, and obviously it was in our interest to do as he wants because he could see more.
But you would then be picking your own route
picking
forward.
Your own route. Yeah. The driver was always responsible for the actual route he took.
Yes.
He was told which way to go. And carefully he would go that way. If he had to go fast, well, of course, the commander said, move fast. And, of course, you moved fast.
Was the Sherman responsive to acceleration?
Quite a good, yes.
Did you ever suffer a mechanical breakdown while you were operating in Normandy?
Not really. We had this problem when our sponsons were shot away.
Well, it's enemy action, though, isn't it?
Yeah,
really?
But that was repaired overnight. But we didn't have a breakdown. We had a diesel tank, which was very reliable.
What about the tracks? Because they used to break sometimes, didn't they?